Hello, everybody, and welcome to the October 12th, 2016 edition of Weekly Manga Recap. It's October, which means it's Halloween month!
Ooh, Nick, you gotta get into it! It's spooky! See, SiriusXM this year doesn't have the channel, the Halloween channel, which is just 24/7 chain rattling and like spooky noises with the occasional monster mash thrown in every half hour or so.
There were as many Halloween songs as there were Christmas songs.
So we need to deliver that audio Halloween flavor that the rest of the world is missing now. So
spooky, scary, scary.
Yeah. So in the background, I may just have scary sounds playing every so often, like "Ooh, it's a ghost," or "Ooh, Donald Trump's a legitimate presidential candidate."
Well, I mean, as much as one can be.
In the sense that
he is going to be on the ballot.
Yeah, in the sense that he is going to be on the ballot. Because this is Halloween month, I thought I'd open by trying to find something scary to talk about, Nick. So okay. I started thinking about, like, what are the scariest things that happened to me? And I remember, I'm ADD, I think everybody's well aware. And back in the 90s, the drug to cure, or not to cure, but to help treat ADD was Ritalin. I was allergic to Ritalin, though. I couldn't take it.
Wow.
So my parents, my mom, I should say, dad wasn't around. He was a deadbeat dad a little bit. That's like the one Weekly Manga Recap he tuned into, just a single solitary tear. But my mom went to go, like, was working with doctors, trying to find something else, because this was before Adderall. There wasn't Adderall at that time. So they had me in a whole bunch of different kind of drugs to try to find one that worked. And there was one which didn't help my ADD at all, and it made me paranoid with terror at the most illogical things. I would literally be unable to sit back in my seat because I thought there was going to be like a gremlin's hand that was going to rip out of the chair and like claw my back open. And at school, we had these chairs with like little shelves underneath the seat where you put your books. And I wouldn't.
Right, I remember those.
I couldn't reach my hand in to pull my books out or even sit still in the seat because I was like, there's snakes underneath there. There's snakes.
Wow.
Now, my brother and sister, of course, loving siblings that they were, used this to torture me. They would literally, like, shifting uncomfortably in my seat, they're like, I think I see something rumbling in the back of the seat. Something's definitely in there. And I was terrified, Nick. Terrified.
I mean, I guess that makes sense. I mean, you know, ADD is what has to do with hyperactivity and stuff. And so if you, that's kind of tampered with to just use all sorts of different sensations that you're feeling to imagine something that could be there. Ugh.
Yeah. And from that, Nick, I actually feel like I can somewhat closely relate to the recommendation that we are reading this week. Or that we
I do get that.
Week.
Yeah. Actually, I have a story that somewhat matches that, too. Okay. Like, I don't have too many experiences of being scared, like, unless it's, you know, like, adult concerns. Like, you know, I don't know what's happened to someone that I care about because I haven't heard from them in a while. Like, the last message that I got from somebody was them to be about a worry situation. I don't have any means of reaching them, and it takes a while for them to actually update me, and so I'm worried about that. The last thing that I remember being really creeped out would have been when I was in college. And I lived off campus, but I would visit my friends on campus, and we would meet up and play D&D because we were a bunch of fucking nerds. And there was one time when we played until fairly late. I think it was like, I don't know, 3 a.m. maybe when we stopped. And then I had to walk back to my car, which was a significant distance away because parking on campus is always shit, you know. Mm. And it was dark and nobody was out. So it was just that feeling when you're in the dark completely by yourself, and it was a wide open darkness too. So I kept, you know, looking behind me. I checked the back seat of my car when I got inside and all sorts of stuff. That's the kind of thing that the series that we took the recommendation for is really about. It's just, it basically tells you that creeping feeling that you've got there's a real reason behind it. Mm-hmm. If you think that you see something, you did see something. Even if you look and you don't see anything, no, you did see something before. If you think that you feel somebody behind you, there is somebody behind you. Even if you look behind you and there's nobody there, no, there's somebody behind you. That's what Fuan Otani is about. It translates to a couple of different things. I think it's like seeds of anxiety, reason for concern.
I believe the literal translation is people's faces in places where there shouldn't be faces, and that is scary, apparently. And, that's the whole title.
People's faces when they look weird are scary. Eyes, mouths. Lack of eyes or mouths.
If you go up like the first seven or so chapters or short stories, whatever you want to call them, you would assume that the mangaka thinks the most terrifying thing in the world is like looking into a window and seeing the person's face. Cause that's like the first like six or so in a row are just those sort of things. But it's a tough series to sort of describe because when we say short stories, we mean literally like sometimes 3 or 4 pages long. If I could compare it to anything, every so often on Reddit, they'll do one of those things like, what's your scariest story in 2 sentences? And it'll be like, my phone rang saying it was my mother. My mother's been dead for 10 years or something like that. You're like, ooh, that's creepy. That's essentially what
these
are. I
hate those, by the way, because 90% of them are, but they've been dead.
Yeah. But that's what a lot of these are in that same way, that it's just a tease. You don't find out a resolution most times. It's just something that gives you a lingering sense of dread or... Well, those are the ones that are even trying for that. This is a weird, eclectic mixture in these short stories, wherein some are trying to be weird, some are trying to be kind of creepy and gross, some are trying to be funny, some are trying to actually be heartwarming, and then some are just inane and crazy, and I don't know what the point of them was, and then some are just plain stupid.
When we say, you know, like, short stories, yeah, it's like that. You know, I went into this because it was introduced as, okay, you know, each chapter covers this short little story, and it's a 3-volume series. It's like, okay, no problem. We'll, you know, go through this, we'll see a few different scary stories, and there'll be this nice little collection that we'll have to talk about. It's not like, Are You Afraid of the Darkling, though.
No.
It's, you know, haunted ghost tour-length stories, if that. I don't know if you've ever gone on one of those where he's like, you know, this town's got all these ghost stories. Come with me and I'll tell them to you as I point out different locations. And just like those ghost stories, it's just, you know, someone saw this creepy thing that has no explanation. Okay. Who is that person? It was somebody. Okay. What was the ghost they saw? It looked like this. Yeah. But did they see it do anything? They say that that someone murdered their family in this house. Okay, so has anyone died in that house since then? Well, sometimes you can hear the... No. Yeah, nothing really happens in a lot of these stories. Sometimes the implication is of something that has happened is very clear, and in some cases it is very gruesome. There's one where, like, there's this weird figure that's stalking these two girls who are walking on their way home from school, and he's snipping a pair of scissors in each hand, and somehow he manages to remotely cut one of their ears off. There's one story where a girl is playing hide and seek. She comes into this abandoned shack, and there's this other girl there, and the girl says, "They'll never find you here. It's a good hiding place." And of course, nobody ever finds her, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's a bunch of stories that don't hit the mark nearly as well. A lot of times, here's how a story goes. Chapter end.
Credits, yes.
And I'm sorry to anyone who's not watching the stream or the YouTube, but yeah, somebody's walking along, they look over their shoulder, face, chapter end.
Yes.
Way too many of the stories are just that, where someone sees something creepy, and that's literally it.
I could understand it because they're meant to play off that idea of just, like, those moments where if you have a lot of fear, or those moments where fear strikes you, where you're trying to insert something scary into your life where there isn't one, it actually does put the monster there. But because they're all short stories, there's no resolution. These stories aren't connected in any way. They just all happen one after another. They're all just ideas, essentially. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are almost just like premises. Like, almost like an idea that someone pitched out at a meeting for like a scary movie and we're like, yeah, I mean, those are some pretty good storyboards. Let's see if we could extrapolate that into a whole movie or something like that. Like, there's nothing, there's very few actual stories that I ever got, like, not even scared, but just like, I thought like, ooh, that's kind of creepy. There's a handful, but there's so many more that are just like, that was just weird. And some are just meant to be like supernatural. They're not even meant to be scary, but there are some that are just dumb. Some funny dumb, but then there are some that are just dumb. To give you an example of funny dumb, one of my favorites might be the one of the two children on the crosswalking sign who are just smiling happily, and it's like seven shots. It's just a safety crosswalking sign, and they're smiling happy, and then one panel, their eyes like grow into like demonic ones and peer at one dude, and you just see in a panel, you just see like thunk, and they go back to being happy. Like, presumably, they were glaring at somebody, cursed him, he or she got hurt, and now they're happy and pleased by this. And that's it. That's the entire story. There's no context to why they hate this dude. It's like you see a shot of him littering or jaywalking or something like that. They just, for one fucking person, they hated the shit out of him, cursed him, and were very pleased that he got his comeuppance. That's it.
There's a similar, there's a similar premise in another chapter that I think is a lot more complete, where this guy is riding his bicycle and he sees a shadowy group of figures and he gets distracted by them and he's looking over at them, and as a result of looking over at them, he gets like hit by a truck. And so, you know, people are getting out, they're like, oh my god, yeah, what's happened to this guy? And they don't see the shadowy figures that are surrounding him, but the shadowy figures are smirking because they've caused this guy to die. So, you know, like, you know, that sounds like, you know, the premise or the formula for a ghost story. You know, they say that, you know, they're shadowy figures, but if you stop and acknowledge them while you're riding by, then, you know, they're just trying to distract you from the danger and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. And they say that they still lurk on by the highways where cyclists roam or whatever.
But that's,
how do you want to word that?
That's the thing. Like, that one could be considered, like, almost kind of interesting. Then there are some that are just inane, like the toilet ghost one, where it's a door. This guy's going to some dude's bathroom, and he sees in the door, the door's kind of, like, has that texture where it almost seems like there's a face on the door. And the guy, like, looks at it, and he's like, this door's kind of creepy. And then the face on the door kind of glares at him, and he's like, I'm going home. And that's it. That's the whole fucking short story. And you're like,
there's a two,
what
there's
is
a two
this?
Page, there's a two-page chapter very late in the series where literally a girl's walking on the phone. She hears something like the fence behind her rattle really creepily. And she looks behind her. She doesn't see anything. She's like, oh, I guess it was the wind. That's it. There's no follow-up. There's no figure or anything that's peeking out from the background that really shook the fence. It's just, no. She heard the fence rattling, and then she dismissed it because it was probably the wind. And we're led to believe that it actually was.
Yeah. it's weird because on one hand, I think, like, I'm like, all right, well, this is, like, an inane sort of, like, series. There's not much substance to it because a lot of these premises are just silly. But there are a few that actually I find interesting. Like, the one that I think creeped me out the most was the one where it's a boy looking out his telescope and he sees, like, a figure on a building. And he spots the figure. And you don't even see the figure turn. But he has his, like, thought process dialogue. He's like, that's the first time I saw it. And ever since then, and it, you know, it changes transition into his room where he's sleeping. And ever since then, it started coming here too. And you see him sleeping, like trying to sleep, but the figure's now outside his window. And you're like, that's kind of creepy. Like, it's his curiosity that's had him see this creature, but now it's essentially invited him to be stalked by it now. Like, it's a creepy premise. Not enough to make me, like, lose sleep, but I'm like, it's an interesting idea. And it's also in that same realm of, like, he's not a bad person, but it was his action that caused it to follow him. Just that, like, byproduct sort of thing that I think can make horror interesting. And there are also some that are just interesting without being scary. The one where a boy's walking around town with a teddy bear, and he's showing all these things.
I like that. I like that little story.
Yeah. It was something that wasn't, it was very supernatural. It was very, like, a little creepy just in the sense that it's a teddy bear talking to people, apparently. but it was inherently for a good reason. I was like, I think more stories like that would be something I'd really enjoy. But there's so many more that are just like, it's a road of eyeballs! And you're like, I get it, but I don't... Why? Why?
There are a couple of ones that really stood out to me in terms of, like, I don't think that this was... I'm not sure if this was meant to be scary. There's one where it's a hospital.
Oh, yeah.
And the nurses occasionally will just see this little kid whose face is almost entirely a giant mouth, and he's like, give me a hug. I promise I won't bite. And it's like, they don't acknowledge it. They ignore it. They don't even talk about it to each other because they're afraid of what will happen. It's just like, but it's, you know, this weird, creepy thing, and everyone's just like, get out of the way. Just yeah. refusing to acknowledge it, and it doesn't affect them. Okay.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, we all agree to just not talk about the mouth baby, I guess.
Probably my favorite little story is one where this guy senses a disturbance in his house. And so he's moving around his bedroom, and he gets a gun to defend himself. He opens the door to confront the intruder, and as the ghost is there, he's like, oh, wait, sorry, this is the wrong place. And he crawls through the wall to go to the right house.
That's what I love. I was like, that story is inherently just for fun. Like, it's just meant to be funny. Yeah. So I like those ones. It's weird. I feel like, first and foremost, this is not a long series. You could all read it's all not. Three volumes in like a half hour if you
it
really read
it. It ran for like 2.5 years, but because each chapter is only a couple of pages long, I think it goes up to 6 at the most, then it only filled 3 volumes. And a lot of them have very little dialogue because they're just mostly built around trying to build up this creepy feeling and then have the reveal of a creepy figure. And that's it. Very easy to follow stories. Not a whole lot to get through. I mean, you can read through this entire thing in probably like an hour if you really try.
But in that way,
it's easy to get through. And there are a couple of enjoyable moments here and there. But I do have to think that if you took this in the form that it was originally, which was, you know, just like little snippets here and there, that it would have probably been a little bit better, because then you could just have an occasional little dose of a little creepy story, as opposed to going through all of them and realizing how many of them are basically the same thing. You know, if you read through all of this in an hour, then you're probably not going to have it as impacted, because it's like, you know, when you have a jump scare in a movie, a jump scare is only effective if you have build for it, and then if you do a whole bunch in a row, then they really start to lose their impact. So, because each of these very short chapters has to end on giving you that creepy sensation, then, okay, creepy sensation, and then less than a minute later, because the chapter flies by so quickly, another creepy sensation, and the next chapter flies by so quickly, another creepy sensation. Then you really become dulled to it.
Mm.
So I don't know how well this would have worked if we, you know, had been reading, say, the original magazine that it came out in, and then came across, oh, Onotane, oh, that one was creepy. That one not so much. And apparently this was quite a successful series. It got somehow adapted into a movie. Which I don't know how.
I guess you would just connect the scariest stories. You'd actually like make a regular character. I don't know. I feel like for me, it's a series that I want to recommend, particularly to people who like scary things. But the issue with it is that it's so up and down and back and forth upon which story you're going to get. That it's. I have a very different impression of the series based on what short story I read last. So, like, if I read one of the ones I found scary or interesting, I'd be like, oh, yeah, definitely, go through it, because it's not very long to read, and you might find some interesting stuff in there. But if I end on one of the ones that's just another, like, quasi-scare, or, you know, like, shadowy figure coming towards you, or any of those ones that's just kind of generic after a while, then I'd be like, eh, I mean, even though there's a couple good ones... Eh, you don't really need to waste your time with it. If there was a way that I could, like, essentially isolate the, like, what I find to be the best ones and, like, give that to people, I definitely think they'd enjoy it, but I mean, all things considered, it didn't leave enough of an impact on me that I'd be like, oh yeah, definitely like on a scary night on Halloween, if you're looking for something like spooky to read, this will be the one to go to. And it's like, eh, I don't know. Watch some Twilight Zone.
Yeah, that about sums it up for me. I was expecting the series to be very different based on the, like, opening of it, which I think was done for the volume versions, which is this, like, finger, like, peeling away part of the cover in order for a creepy eye to glare through at you. Some of the chapters are like that because, yeah, I do agree with you. I think the mangaka thinks that eyes are the scariest thing.
Yeah, it's that and faces, either not having a face or having like a face that's weird in some way. Like that is the most terrifying thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, it's interesting. I'll give it that if nothing else. It's interesting to read. So there we go. That's it. Fuwan no Tane.
We're gonna do the recap portion of Ukumaga recap now. Just as a little bit of a heads up for you guys, I'm probably going to be a bit quieter for this episode. It's just, I've been recovering from a cold the last couple of days, and I'm trying to save myself from getting dehydrated. I drink enough goddamn water on this podcast as is. So, Chris is going to be taking the reins.
I'm going to be taking the reins in Spooktober!
Hey.
So our first series this week is going to be Amalgam of Distortion, which is...
New Jumpstart.
Yes, which is the most metal jump name I've ever seen. Amalgam of Distortion. That's a band just waiting to happen.
It sounds like a meta band too, considering...
I see it, I'm like, alright, this series had...
Crank of the Distortion.
Yeah, this series had one shot, because it was not going to be able to suck with that name. It couldn't just be, like, complete garbage. It had to rock at that name, so... I actually thought it was Amalgam of Destruction, which is why it says that in the poll. It's also the reason why there's no One Piece in the poll this week. So, the series starts with our main character here, Rukumichi. And you'll have to forgive me, guys, if I don't know a lot of these names this week. That's what I rely on Nick for, so you just got to deal with me occasionally calling people by random generic terms that describe their appearance and thus have to identify them. So, Rukumichi's talking to Skirt Girl, and she is basically their childhood friends who have a kind of combative relationship with one another. He is, you know, kind of jabby with her. They have a bit of a flirtatious, combative relationship, so to speak. And she is angry at him because he doesn't seem to take anything too seriously. He doesn't apologize. He's just kind of a lazy guy. His friend basically notices that he has a crush on her. What's actually her name? I should actually know
Yaoi.
Her name. Yaoi? All right,
Skirt, Yaoi.
He has a crush on Skirt Girl. And his friend...
Or Hino.
Hino works. There we go. His friend takes his cell phone and basically texts Hino for him, saying, I have something important I need to tell you later. And as...
Well, the way he words it makes it seem like he wants to fight her.
Yes. It's phrased the way, like, I need to speak with you and let's settle this, essentially, or something along those mm-hmm. lines. Rukumichi is kind of bummed about this, and as he's like thinking of what's gonna happen, the new guy at school, Ishu Koromizu, passes by.
Close enough.
Yeah. It's fuck you. Don't sass me. We cut away then.
You're doing great.
To essentially with the two of them meeting, and as exactly as you said, Hino assumes this is going to be a fight. She takes a battle stand, she has her hands at the ready, she's like, we shall begin! And Rukumichi's like, begin what? And she's trying to run away. She's like, oh, trying to talk your way out of it. What a joke. Here comes the ultimate technique of the blood splurt style. She trips. Or no, sorry. He slips. She, I guess, falls out of, I don't know, like, you know, I went.
I think she goes to pin him. don't know.
I don't know. She says oops as well.
I think that his slip manages to make him luckily avoid her attack.
I like to think it's like yawning, and he slipped and she unconscious. It's just like, I have to slip too!
I don't know, man. If one person in Japan trips, that means that there's a domino effect. Just the entire fucking street. That's what causes earthquakes.
Yeah, like, oh man, another person in Japan fell down. So Hino's basically saying, like, nice dodging, idiot. You know, why are you dodging? You said you were going to settle this for good, right? So you called me out here. What are you doing? Rukumichi's like, no, I need to explain this to you. I just wanted to ask you out on a date. And she backs off and she starts blushing, Nick, because she's kind of nervous. And Rukumichi's friend said, you know, watch for her reaction because that's going to tell you what's up. And because she backs up and kind of runs away, Rukumichi's like, oh, she doesn't like me. But then as she's leaving, she's like, you want to go to this park? It's a popular destination for dates. It's not like I like you or anything. But she actually does say, I mean, going on a date with you? All right, but it's a promise. You better be there. So, Nick, with only 20 or so chapters left in this, I think Rukumichi and Hino's relationship's going to work out. He's going to be there at that date. Just like Jim Carrey at the first act of Liar Liar, he's going to be there for his kid when he says he's going to.
Well, I have to say, because I had no idea what this series was going to be about. If you look at that two-page color spread, obviously there's going to be something weird in this series, because you see Rokumichi slumped over at his desk, and there's this weird figure in his silhouette.
Yeah.
And then you get about halfway through this chapter, and suddenly it's like, huh, the main couple that's being teased for the series is planning on going on a date. This is refreshing, but what's going to happen to stop them from ending up happy together?
Yeah, you're like, something tells me with the name Amalgam of Distortion, this probably isn't a romantic comedy. So Rukumichi's happy. He's like, oh, my heart's beating so fast. Oh, I'm so excited. This must be what it's like to be happy, you know. He's actually bumps into like a train crossing pole. And that's when he sees a young boy has just crossed underneath the pole. So Rukumichi dives out to go save him, but the boy trips on one of the train tracks. Rukumichi goes out to push him, but his hand goes through him completely. And it's actually a pretty devastating panel. You just see Rukumichi's expression, then the outside perspective of the train crushing by. You don't see it happen, but the very obvious implication is he got crushed by that train.
The very violent sound effect, too.
Yes. Crash, yes. So we cut away and we see a bunch of scientists in a lab talking about their new subject that's coming in and how, did you hear about our new subject? The chief hologram, or the hologram chief made for a laugh. Haha, that guy actually thought it was the real thing. So they're, you know, referring to that Ghost Boy actually was a hologram, it seems. We actually then get Rukumichi's inner dialogue, or inner thoughts as he's waking up. And he's like, what's happening? Oh, there's a kid coming, and oh man, it's so suffocating here. And that's when we see that Rukumichi is nothing more than a torso, a right arm, and his head, essentially, at this point. And he's kind of floated around in the tank of liquid. He's hooked up to a bunch of things.
Chris, we finally know the origin of the Soul King.
That's where the other arm went. See, I'm having bad Weapon X flashbacks right now. So, essentially a flashback to every X-Men movie ever.
Because all of them had to have Wolverine flashbacks.
Yeah. So, we see a doctor commenting on the fact that Rukumichi's woken up. And it's this very energetic woman who is talking about what a sexy sight it is as she squishes around and consumes live organs of some kind, it seems. Like,
it looks like intestine.
Yeah, it looks like intestines. Maybe it's haggis. You know? I don't know. But it's directly like right
out of... I'm crazy!
It's directly right out of a bowl and very bloody. So, Rukamichi's like, what's going on? What's happening right now? They're just talking about, you know, like, essentially what they're going to do. They're going to make him into something. And that's when one of the scientists interjects and says, hold on, the experiment could wait a few hours. And that's when we see that one of the scientists is Eishu Kurumizu. Boosh. Got it first try. So you guys see that?
Well, if your first try was all together.
Atsu Kamazu. basically, what Kurumizu does is delay them. He gets them to go scatter about and prepare something else as he talks to Kurumizu directly and says, listen carefully or you're going to die. Like, I'm a good guy. Listen to me. I'm sent here undercover. I'm trying to just collect information. I didn't expect it would be like, you know, you'd be here or a classmate would be here, but I'm going to help you. I'm call my boss. We're going to get you safe. And that's when you hear the voice of the doctor going, tisk, 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 no sighs of relief allowed. As he's like peering from behind one of the vials, like the tank there, essentially. Mm-hmm. That's when she, you know, obviously now she knows that, Kurumizu is a spy. So they have a fight. He pulls out a sword and a bunch of like kunais and they about to have a big fight. But as this is happening, Kurumichi, that's not his name. Is it? Kurumichi? The main character?
You're referring to main character?
Yeah. What's his name? I forgot.
Rokumichi.
Rokumichi. Okay. Rokumichi starts having these cells injected in him. Ayakashi cells.
Rokumichi and Kurumizu is kind of unfair.
he starts having his body injected with all these demonic cells of some kind. We even get like an almost full page spread of seeing them, the cells like actually attack him like fangs, like ripping into his body. And it's all done in like a silhouette with most of the page covered up by his screaming too. And just as, Kurumizu would essentially look like he'd finished the fight, the cell that was trying to hold, Rokumichi in shatters open and he is now a hideous bone monster revealed in this giant two-page spread. The doctor titles him by saying, welcome to the world, number 6, starving skeleton. Chaos ensues, basically. A bunch of fighting going on. Kurumizu tries to fight him off, but he's having trouble. It's a tough opponent for him. I guess these monsters are all very special.
The doctor explains that his power is constantly regenerating bone.
Mm-hmm.
So his body is covered in this bony armor, which makes up the entire mass of this monstrous form. And Eishu is trying to fend it off, but every time that he, you know, carves some of it off, it just grows right back immediately. Yes. And she explains that the only thing that you could possibly do would be to kill the body inside in order to stop it.
Exactly. So essentially he would have to kill his classmate, which she presumably throws out there as a way to throw him off. But instead, Kurumizu is more steeled than ever. He's like, he's dead. The only thing that's standing there is a monster. So he says he's going to kill it because he's a hero. At which point, the monster starts breaking apart. And that's when we see that Rokumichi is not in fact dead. He is actually trying to be in control of the creature. We can see that he's kind of having a struggle with it. Like, oh, this pain's excruciating. And I'm so tired. I can't keep my eyes. But after all these years of receiving punches and kicks from you, Hino, this is nothing. So he breaks out of the bones. The entire, like, creature collapses. And all that's left of the bone stuff is essentially limited just to Rokumichi's body that was lost. So essentially from his torso down and his left arm. The doctor essentially is just so excited about this. Like, ooh, the Ayakashi cells in his mind are a complete match. Is this the best result or what? And Rokumichi just says, like, you know, what made me push this far is because I remembered I promised I'd go on a date with her. And doctor just kind of laughs. She's like, whatever. Got the result I kind of wanted. But she's like, you pique my curiosity, or you prick my curiosity like no one else has. I have an idea. How about you and I go on a date? And that's when Kuromizu's like, I'm still here. I'm going to kill you now. And she's
We're going on a date.
Yeah. She's like, nah, I'm just going to peace out for now. So she does. She essentially poofs out of there and has
replaced herself with a hologram that she had demonstrated earlier.
So now it's just Rukubichi and Kuromizu. Great. These guys were friends a moment ago. They'll just happily join together and go to fight this evil organization. Except Kuromizu sees a demon in front of him. He sees a monster. He says, no matter what, I'm sorry, but you must die for the sake of this world peace. You know, the world peace. So, presumably, he's going to try to kill him.
Yeah, that's the end of this chapter.
Yeah,
that's... I love the hell out of this first chapter. Mm-hmm. I like the setup. I thought it was very effective way of, it was just from start to finish of this whole thing. It is incredibly paced. You are introduced to these characters. And then as the action kicks in, Rokumichi has gotten a chance to really endear himself to the audience because he seems like an actual everyday guy. But you see that little mark of he's a good person because he tried to save that kid. He threw himself literally in front of a moving train to try and save this kid. And then he has this horrible stuff happen to him. So you feel sympathy for his situation. And then when he breaks free, well, the reason for why he's able to do it, you've seen established at the beginning of the chapter, is because of his feelings for Yayoi. And there's also that little mark of, oh, it's because she was beating me up that I've got this high pain tolerance, and so I'm able to resist this. But in the end, you know, it comes down to he made a promise to somebody, and he wants to be with the girl that he likes. You know, very strong characters, the four main ones that we get, you know, the scientist, Eishu, and Rokumichi, and Yayoi, all really just come together very well. I love the hell out of this first chapter, and I want to see everything that the series can offer right now.
Yeah. This series actually, first, it feels very fitting to have this introduced during Halloween month, because it does have very, mm-hmm. like, creepy elements.
Bone demon hero!
Exactly. Now, initially, when I was reading through this, I didn't, you know, I was noting, like, the art's pretty good, but I wasn't really finding anything too crazy about it. You know, the initial setup is very, like, kind of everyday shonen, like, main character, cute girl he likes, childhood friends, she's, like, a bit of a tomboy badass, like, you know, martial artist or something like that. But, you know, when he asks her out on a date and she agrees, I'm already like, huh, well, that's kind of unique. And again, I'm already into the art in this series. It's when he shows up in the facility that you're like, oh, wow, this has a tremendous amount of, like, well-executed bits to it. Like, everything works at this point. Like, I found Rokumichi, as you said, to be, like, compelling and interesting. I found Kuromizu to be very engaging and kind of interesting because he makes sense, but you still feel like there's something off about him. Like, you're like, oh, good, he's a noble character, but there's still something a little bit strange about him, like, particularly that line where he's like, I will be a hero. Like, there's something kind of weird. Maybe it's just the art, but you're like, oh, it's like an interesting sort of thing you're seeing. And just everything was executed so well. The art's fantastic, so it makes the action even more exciting. The characters are all really unique and dynamic, and they look all very, just have a strong aesthetic quality to them. I really, really enjoyed this series. It was a complete surprise.
Yeah, I like the stuff that we're getting from Eishu, in terms of he seems very cold and calculating, but at the same time, he's got that bit where, you know, he feels the need to reassure Rokumichi, it's okay, I'm a good guy, and that he protests to the doctor saying, hey, maybe you should belong on our side with that, you know, kind of absolutism you got going. He's like, no, I'm a hero. Mm-hmm. You know, that belief that he is right in just a couple of little words is interesting. I was so fascinated by this that I looked up the stuff that the author has done before. There's actually not a whole lot that they've done.
I was going to say, I believe this is his second series.
His second jump series.
Second jump, yes.
And They also did a seinen one before. What was it called? Something like, something Condor, was what it was called. And, Yarakubi? Something like that. It was about an immortal with, like, ghost invisibility powers that was trying to gather treasures and stuff. So another premise that was, you know, definitely adventure kind of oriented, but with a different setup than just they fight. So maybe that kind of, the office kind of has that taste for slightly non-mainstream stuff. And maybe that influences what's doing the whole, well, first of all, the bone demon thing. But this was really weird because it's like, it starts off, you're kind of expecting it to be like Love Rush, honestly.
Yeah.
With, you know, a seemingly ghost kid and the love friends and stuff. So I literally knew nothing about this. And so I was like, is it going to be like that beginning of Yu Yu Hakusho, but you know, a romantic comedy rather than action that just swerves off into, he is a giant bone monster now.
it is interesting. It's tough for me on one hand, because I do see a lot of like, the influences of this in other series. As you said, it, you know, has the same initial premise in a way that Yu Yu Hakusho did, you know, tries to push a kid out of the way of a car, ends up getting killed in the process or killed. And the idea that like the main hero is infected with something that presumably the bad guys have is something that's been done in a lot of series. D. Gray Man's the first one that jumps into mind, but it's everything that this series did in this first chapter was just well executed. And for that, I really enjoy it. That's, I think, more important to me than having the most original idea. I just like to see things well executed, and I feel like this really executed everything in a spectacular way.
Yeah.
So, let's move on to our regular series that we talk about, starting with Black Clover, chapter 81, page 81, Because He's Like That. So, if you recall from last time, Asta's arm is damaged essentially beyond repair, that there's no magic that could fix it. However, the members of the Black Bulls are going on a mission to find it. They think that there's somewhere out there where it can be, you know, magic exists that could fix it. So Asta wakes up, and he goes out into like the main lobby essentially, and he's like, "Oh, hey, Yami, where is everybody?" And he's like, "Don't know." And Asta has this moment where he's just staring into like the abyss, and I have to assume like a minute passes by before he like the thought bubble actually pops up that he's like, are they all playing hooky? Like he just stares into nothingness for a while, but he's like, oh, wait, I could sense ki, I could find them no matter where they are. So he, I guess, actually uses that to try to find
a look extra... out the window.
Yeah, I guess he used it to sense them, but he finds Noelle and Finrul. And I guess he can actually hear through the window as well. So Noelle is talking to him the fact that, like, yeah, you know, we sent everybody out. And they do that thing where, like, they obviously are in the plan, but they have to explain it.
Let's reiterate the plan to each other.
From beginning to end. So they do. They explain that we're all secretly trying to find a way to cure Asta. And because Asta would never ask us to do this himself, he
now
knows,
don't
first.
Talk about this too loud because we want to surprise him.
So they mentioned everybody's going off doing this, and that Yami, hold on. Well, I guess it's on a mission. I guess they have to be sneaky about it, or Mr. Yami will get mad. So I guess Yami doesn't even technically know.
I don't think he cares.
Yeah, I don't think he'd care anyway.
he's just chilling in the barracks reading a newspaper like.
So we got a cut to show what all the different members are doing. So Magna and Luck are off at a wild dungeon in the Forsaken Realm trying to see if there's a cure maybe in there. So that seems very fitting. They're both the actional members of the guild. Gaush and Gordon are researching sorcery at the Royal Library. And I just like this, because Gordon's response, like everybody has something to say, Gordon's is, I'm going to make friends with Asta too. He doesn't even fucking know the guy yet. And he's like, I can't wait to be friends with him. I fucking love Gordon.
Then I'll get super power-ups and determination from friendship with him.
I never want Gordon to meet the other characters. I want him to just always be talking about how cool it'll be when it happens, though.
We're going to get, like, several years down the line, we're going to get this 20-chapter guide-in of Gordon going and saving a kingdom all by himself, meeting the love of his life and having to leave her behind because he has his mission as a Black Bull to do, and traveling back and nobody paying attention to him or taking him on any missions ever again. He just shows him the background as a joke every now and again.
He's essentially Ishimaru after, like, the Kanto tournament, where they were just like, oh, right, you're still on the team. Charmy and Gray are off searching for unknown foods that are effective against curses. And they specifically mention that, oh, sorry, they actually have a moment here beforehand, where Fenrir's like, who would have thought that the worst, toughest, roughest brigade would be working so hard for this newbie? And Noelle's like, yes, even for a dumb, reckless, vulgar, magicless peasant like this one. And we see Asta's thinking about all the different people that have insulted him in life without their, like, eyes or mouths. Like, it's just kind of like the masks of them. And it's
like
people saying,
it's like the comedy and tragedy masks.
Yeah. Where he's just like, you don't have to try anymore. You're just a filthy little rat who doesn't belong here. A peasant from the boonies in this world.
Chris, you're not doing the voice right.
Yeah, you need to train more. You're a filthy rat. There's a big dog here. Magicless. I actually like that a lot, though. I like Asta kind of, like, seeing there and having it kind of brought to him. But Fenrir continues to, like, but even though he has no magic, he just refuses to go up, you know, give up. And, you know, he's even the first to go into battle when he fights harder than anyone. And because he's like that, because Asta's like that, he gave us the strength to fight, so now it's our turn to help him. And Asta just overhears that part. And then he walks away from the window, walks outside, looks into the sky, and just starts crying. Because he's like, I wasn't blessed with any magic, and it always frustrated me, but I sure was blessed with good friends. And Yami just exhales from out there, and he's like, I wish they'd work harder at their jobs. I wish these guys would make
me love that. I do love that comment. It's like, man, if only they were this dedicated when it came to anything except that asshole.
And Fenrir's super excited, because he's like, all right, let's go on a mission together, Noelle. And she's like, no, I have my own things to do. And that's when Fenrir's like, wait, where did Vanessa go? She disappeared before anyone else. And we cut away to a forest and this stone wall with a interesting set of, like, wooden doors, giant wooden doors, which Vanessa's in front of. And she inhales before screaming out, hey, the greatest witch genius since the founding of the country of witches has returned. I've got a little business here, so open up. The doors open up with a flock of bats that envelops Vanessa. Or sorry, I guess they're birds, actually. Yeah, they're ravens. That envelop Vanessa and then flap away, and when they, you know, move away, Vanessa's gone and the doors slowly creak closed. That's the chapter.
Look at Asta's stupid fucking face.
I feel like in an alternate world where fiction and reality are real, you would be Asta's bully. Like, in school, you were the kid that picked on him.
I would be the one finally.
And then, like, years later, you needed Asta's help and he saved you, and you two actually became friends. You're like the Biff Tanner, essentially, of Asta's life. I actually like this chapter a lot. I like that this is Asta kind of having a little moment of, like, acceptance. Like, again, we don't see him depressed. And from this, you could kind of almost see that, you know, he mentioned it last week as well, that if he did, he would just fall apart. And it's kind of nice seeing here that he does have an emotion, that he does, like, you know, it's not all just pure jubilation. In this, it's like him crying because he's grateful. And it's like, okay, he doesn't take what he has for granted. He's just, you know, a nice kid from time to time. Be a little annoying. But he's slowly earning that way to being likable. You guys remember the big like complaint we always had is that, you know, he was like Naruto, but without the sympathetic backstory. And I'm slowly able to get more behind this kid, and that makes everything else he does a lot more easier to tolerate. So I like that, and I like seeing where the different members of the guild are going to try to help him. Plus, I think that ending with Vanessa is just fucking badass. I love that flock of like birds coming out and just swallowing her, and then the doors close.
I do... I think that at this point... Asta is being positioned to stop being a... Stop having the, you know, oh, sympathetic, sad backstory where everyone looks down on him and now just will become, you know, the central protagonist people rely on. And he'll use that more as his motivation. And I can't imagine that being... That making me hate him more than the, oh, he doesn't have magic, but he's somehow still stronger than almost anyone, so what fucking difference does it make? So, I'm basically going to repeat what I said last time. I appreciate the effort. I'm going to keep my mind open, and I can definitely foresee this making him more likable. I still hate that little kid.
I think if nothing else, I can at least appreciate the fact that a problem was put before Asta and it wasn't solved in the subsequent chapter. It feels like...
No, he just didn't worry. He just didn't worry about it at all. That's all. It didn't affect him emotionally whatsoever.
Nick, you are the kind of man who could find an insult in a bouquet of verses. Moving on to Scary Tale, Chapter 505, Trump Card.
At least I don't have to do two boo puns in a row this year, because Bleach is gone.
So, Irene lifts up her staff and enchants the entire battlefield, enchanting her entire army of soldiers and turning them into berserkers, which causes their hair to catch fire and other stuff. And it's super intimidating because they're all stronger now. I forget that she did the same thing with Reinhardt and he was still defeated. It doesn't matter. This time, it's scary.
There's so many of them, Chris.
Yes, there's so many members of this giant, you know, fucking army that even the members of Fairy Tail whose powers are like, I draw things on my belly, are still like, oh, I can barely keep up with all of them. This greatest army in the world.
Well, you know, it's like if you throw an AoE buff on a bunch of minions, Chris. You know, the more there are, the more effective the spell is. So if it's a super awesome buff, then it's super awesome even if the minions are super weak.
That is true. So, they are actually kicking the shit out of Fairy Tail's lesser guild members. Essentially no one important's left at this point. Like, everyone else, like Wendy, Lucy, Natsu, Gray, Gijio, all those characters are gone right now. So the only people we're seeing...
Urza's the only one there.
Yeah, the only people we see getting the shit pushed in are, like, the Native American guy, whose name I don't remember, the guy from the opening chapters of the series who has that son Marco, who that might be his name. I think he's Marco, and then Marco's other friend.
His kid is Romeo.
Yeah, it's a lot of those guys. So they're getting their shit pushed in, and that's when Makrob's like, "Is this where it ends? No. What ends here is my journey." And everyone's like, "That's stance! That's fairy law!" And Mavis starts running towards him. She's like, "No, you mustn't!" And he's, you know, "The fairy law drains your life! The greater number of enemies, the greater toll on your body! Against this many, you will not survive!" And Makarov's like, "Shut up, bitch! I'm the first master, and I know that! And I'm prepared! I'm gonna die, and you can't stop me!" And she's like, "I have a plan! It can definitely work!" He's like, "Shut the fuck up! No time for this! None whatsoever!" Oh, Nick cut out. Our Skype call fell apart. Alright, well, I'm gonna try calling him again here. See what happens. But while we're waiting for Nick, actually, I think he should still be, I don't know if he's still able to hear me or not. Anyways, while this is happening, Makarov says, I know that you have a plan. I know that that's what you're good at. All right, we'll just throw some covers up, and we'll wait and see. Nick might just be having some internet issues. Makarov says,
Hello.
Hey, I can hear you.
Hello.
Yep, I can hear you. Okay. So, do you want to try on Skype real quick?
You need to restart it?
No, I mean, do you want me to try calling you on Skype again? Because it ended the call on my end.
Oh, it did? Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. It hasn't gone down for me yet.
Oh, that's... So you can see my camera?
I can't see you, no.
Okay.
It's saying that there is a problem. Hang on, let me...
Let me end the call I'm doing then before it screws anything up. Alright. Is it ended on your end?
No.
Okay. Alright, well, I'll just continue on with the recap, and you can just tell me when it's ended on your end, and I'll start up a new
one. Gotcha.
So, Makarov says, like, look, I know that you have a plan. I'm tired of seeing all my kids out there suffering. You know, to you, they're members of an army, but to me, they're my children. I can't lose any of them. So, I know that what you have is a good idea, but I won't see a single drop of my children's blood spilled on the ground anymore. I'm an old soldier here. I don't have much time left anyway. So if I can use what little I do have to give my children a future, then the price is cheap. He continues.
This is so stupid.
He continues then to talk to Urza directly, saying, you know, no matter what trials you face in the future, you'll find a way through them with your friends. Trust in them. Your guild is your family. Never forget that. I've had a delightful journey thanks to you little brats. And everyone's like, no, master! And his last words are, take care of each other. And then he claps his hands together, and the energy channels through, and we see a 2-page spread of fairy law, which might as well have been a blank page. I don't know why he bothered to put anything in there. You can't see shit off this. But we do see that I guess it took out a whole, basically most of the soldiers. I don't know. We don't actually get that much detail into what happens. We just see most of Fairy Tail's reactions, particularly Urza, who drops her sword crying. And the last shot is Makarov perhaps turned to stone?
I think that's what the implication is.
Yeah, it seems to be that's what happened. If not, perhaps his body is going white with all of his energy having left his body. I don't know. That's the chapter.
This is so stupid.
Nick, do you want to make the call now?
He's dead and never coming back.
All right.
My alternate joke, and then Mesgun teleports in and grabs him and teleports him out of the stone. This is so stupid.
Hang on,
I've got a plan in order to protect everyone, Makarov. We can still win. No, I think I'll sacrifice myself. Don't bother.
It's like he's the D&D player who's just tired of playing, and his character is like got caught in a situation he could die, and the DM's clearly trying to do everything they can to save him, but he's like, no, I'm dead. See, I'm at -10 HP. That means I'm dead. Like, well, no, actually, I fudged that number, so you'd only be at -8. Like, no, I'm dead. That's what the numbers say. I'm dead. I don't care. I'm dead.
Got a new character ready to go. I'm sick of playing this old man.
Sick of being this old dude who just gets bigger and then gets punched. This isn't fun.
I want to play a busty hot chick like everyone else.
Like everyone else at this table, I want to play a chick with a fetish.
Barely any of them can win any fights. I don't fucking care.
You have no idea. I'm so tired of writing up stats for another bikini contest. Yeah, well, you better design another one. And I'm going to be that tomboy girl that Nick predicted.
My character never gets put in kinky bondage. Why are you upset about that?
Why are you crying? Oh, yeah, it's... Maybe... Makarov's actually dead. Maybe. But at this point, it's hard to feel much emotion towards this sort of stuff. And that's the chapter. So let's just move on now to Food Wars, or should I say Bood Wars, Shokugeki no Sobuma. Chapter 186, Walking an Umami Tightrope. So, I don't know how you do this series, Nick, because I'm just looking at this and I'm like, how do you recap a series about cooking? So, the battle...
How have you been doing this for several years, Nick?
How do you manage? So, essentially...
You can only use Skype.
I'm sorry? Oh, yeah, right, sorry. We are right now starting the match between Hayama and Soma. And they're both doing bear.
Main
and
character.
Apparently, and they're apparently both going to be doing deep fried bear in some way. And, Soma's thinking to himself, like, I can't mess this up. You know, I got to think about this lean meat, fatty meat. It all goes into the grinder. I need to make sure the five flavor. Oh, come on. Shishandra berries are soaked to make, it's sake to make an extract. I almost said sake. Add to that the ground bear meat, the minced onions, a pinch of salt. You know, if I mess any of that up even a little, the umami flavor becomes a stink bomb. Like, I can't let that happen. I have to just put all my best moves together one after another. And, Doma? Dojima?
Dojima.
Dojima, sorry, there you go. Dojima's like commenting, like, oh, what's Yukihira pouring over the meat? You know, bear meat's, it's actually a soup stock made from the other parts of the bear. And he's like, yeah, but bear meat's already powerfully gamey, and he's adding...
Who would think of making a bear dish with bear stock?
Oh, this genius! As you see, like, Aizen at the side, like, come on, guys, I invented this, that was my thing!
He stole that from me!
Basically just commenting on the fact that this is a very dangerous move for Soma, because he's not pulling back even an inch. He's putting bear stock into his bear meat dish, and bear meat and bear stock is very easy to make, very disgusting. And as Dojima's doing that, he notes that Kuga and the two twins are actually very friendly with each other now, so much so that they were even having a tea party and laughing.
I fucking love this.
And I was like, do you want a cookie Terranori? They're yummy. He's like,
a bunch of 15-year-old kids who were just grabbing each other's cheeks in order to fight each other. And I was like, let's have a tea party.
He's like, oh, sure, I'd love a cookie. Ha ha ha. And like, Kuga's like minions are like, it's kind of disturbing how natural he looks at the tea party there. But now that they note that all of the judges are completely absorbed in the match, or at least the twins are, Dojima's like, oh, but when it comes to walking the fine line of fragrance and flavor, Hayama has the upper hand as he starts throwing out his Cajun spice blend. And he pours it on and he starts, talking about, like, oh, don't worry, I'll make an extra portion of my dish for you, Soma, so you can taste it for comparison's sake. And I don't know how you do it, Nick. I'm just going to skip over all the science talk there. He's making really good fucking spices. them spices is good because of juniper berries.
Mm-hmm.
And these do things.
He's switched from the five flavor berries, apparently.
Yes. So... he talks about how he's making his, essentially, like, the thing he's going to be frying it in the batter. And the girls are like, oh, man, it's really good. I think I want to try it. Like, yeah, I think I do, too. So Hayama actually pulls out a spoon. He's like, go on. I had a little extra left over. And they taste it. And they're like, oh, the strong gaminess of bear without the slightest hint of stink. The sharp and piney sting of the juniper berries. It's all reverberating through my body from the tip of my tongue to the tip of my toes. Incredible. The wild and powerful flavor of the bear meat has been tamed to a bewitching aroma that will entice anyone to try it. With one taste, we too could easily become a pair of well-trained pets. Heart. I do love it when Food Wars has to throw in that fan service, that little extra in there.
Not since squid tentacles with peanut butter. Has the fan service been this weird and kinky?
Yeah.
In fact, this might outdo it, because to explain to you, during that little montage, first off, in reality, what they're doing is timidly approaching Hayama to lick the special sauce from his spoon, which is already suggestive as fuck. Then they freak out, and their imagination scene for how good it tastes is Hayama cracking a whip while they subjugate themselves before him, wearing nothing but string bikinis and bear furry stockings, gloves, and bear ears.
Yes.
Holy shit.
It doesn't...
Like, right now there are tons of horny young men in Japan going, this is my fetish.
This is awoken stuff in a lot of young boys in Japan, I feel like.
Not even necessarily awoken. This is like a common kink, like animal ears on hot girls.
Well, this is when they're like, oh wait, that's my fetish. I just realized that. Like, this is the first time you see it.
Let's count on our fingers. Like, okay, there's the BDSM element from the whip. There's the animal ears. There's twins in bikinis.
It also is a little bit... I think the weirdest element for me is they feel younger than everyone else, even though they aren't. They're 15, which is essentially the age of a lot of the characters in the series. Like, essentially our main cast are all around that age. A couple of the second years that we know and things like that. But it's still like... there's something about the way, I guess, the fact that they were, like, having a tea party and were kind of brought in, like, skipping.
Yeah, they were
and,
just
like,
having that...
dresses.
They were just portrayed as... Just before this, they were being portrayed as very immature. Acting like little kids, you know.
So that's why it's like weird for me. And look, I'm not even like, I get it. I feel like anytime we bring this thing up, people are like, age of consent is 13 in Japan. It's not. I'm not saying it's like that. I'm just saying it's weird in my perspective because that's what I find uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. It's the same thing as, you know, like the Emoto fetish. It's just like you're acting like. You want to sexualize the thing that is sexy to you specifically because it is innocent and cute, you know? It's like a kind of corruption sort of thing that makes you seem kind of creepy.
Yeah. Not condemning anyone if they like this. I'm just saying this was as bad as flagrant as fan service has been in Food Wars in a while. But it's still kind of funny to me, I guess, in a way.
It is. I do think it's actually pretty funny. This is just so blatant.
So they note, Kuga notes like, oh, well, this is, you know, Dojima notes that it's a skilled dish. Obviously, to, like, bring that reaction out of two very skilled tasters like the twins, it must be an exceptional dish. And Kuga's like, whatever. You know, Soma's got an ace or two to pull out of his sleeve. And that's where we see Soma, and he's deep frying his food. As he thinks back to a moment he had with Arina during the exams.
Thinking about it.
Yes, it's kind of confusing because it's essentially, it cuts away to have a flashback. It cuts to Arina, who's, I guess, just doing a standard exam for this portion. Mm-hmm. And she thinks back to a flashback she has about how Soma is being lackadaisical. He's not, you know, seemingly giving this much of a serious attention, you know, it's he just seems like he's relaxing too much. And Soma says, oh, don't worry, I'll make it through. See, there's this guy I gotta have a rematch with to settle an old score. And that's when we cut back to Soma, and he's thinking back to when he was staring at Hayama's back after Hayama was declared the winner of the Fall Classic. And Soma says, you see, I'm glad I lost that day. I'm glad I left home. I need to do this so I could find my specialty. And all I've been doing is following my dad, walking in his footsteps. The chef who sits at the pinnacle of this institute. Thanks, Hayama. If you hadn't beaten me, I wouldn't be the chef I am today. And he pulls his dish out of the deep fryer, and we see that it's actually a deep-fried hamburger. He deep-fried a bear hamburger And Kuga's like, oh yes, it's the lean and fatty cuts he mixed together for a powerful 1-2 punch. He improved the breading to keep every last drop of the bear's flavor tucked inside. And it's a Minchikatsu burger. And he puts the dish down. He says, honor judges, this is my take on the best bear meat dish possible. And it's ready for tasting. Boosh. That's the chapter.
Good chapter overall. I mean, we would, if it had just been the bit where, you know, the girls taste Ayama's dish and freak out over it, and then someone just whips his burger out, which...
It sounded really suggestive.
Well, check out my meat.
I just flip my burger out.
Yeah. Then I would have been like, eh, it was all right. But I do really like the comment of, you know, Soma is grateful towards Hayama, and this match really does mean a lot to him. Not for what's on the line, which I think provides a lot of insight as to why he didn't take Kuga's suggestion of doing the Shokugeki, aside from the fact that just he didn't really care about that. He wanted this chance at Hayama, and he wanted this chance to prove himself and to show how far he's come and to beat him. He's got this grudge against him as the guy who dealt him his harshest defeat, and he wants to beat him for it. So I think that this is a pretty good chapter, and it does make me want to see what these two are going to put towards each other, because obviously we're going to get the judges reacting to Soma's dish, and Hayama's going to put his dish forward, they're going to react to that, and then presumably one or both of them are going to have their special 1-2 punch, which is common for Shokugekis.
Mm-hmm. Now Soma put his dish down first, Nick. What do you think that means? It tends to be putting your dish down first is a way to sign your warrant, sign your death certificate, as they'd say. Yeah. We'll see. So let's move on to my villain, Akabumiya, chapter 110. Shut up. No, you don't. 110, rescue exercise continued. My villain, Akabumiya.
That's terrible.
So we open up with Inasha Yawarashi, which is not how you say that, but his hero name is Gale Force. And Gale Force, which is what I will be calling him from henceforward, says, I'll do my freaking best! And he summons a whirlwind. And one of the injured people's like, wind, huh? This seems really sloppy, you know? But he is sorting people by rubble and, you know, by the shape and size. He's using different air streams. This is a lot of control. But it's still too sloppy. Points deducted! And Gale Force is like, oh, like he doesn't have like a sad reaction. It's just, ah! I'm sorry, my mistake! And we cut over to Meatball Guy, who's the only member of their school, really, of like the important people who's watching on from outside. And he's like, his first reaction is proof of Anasa's training and judgment. People usually wait until their second year for the test, but he petitioned to take it now. What's more, he can back up his talk, which is why they let him. And I don't know who this guy is. It's just
I think he's a teacher.
I guess
at Shinketsu.
I guess he must be, but he doesn't. They don't introduce him as such. But he's just the one talking about him. He's like, yeah, but he's a little too eager. So, you know. And, hey, are you aware you were the only person in our school not to pass? He's like, yeah, I get it. Fuck you. But the teacher actually gives him a piece of advice. Like, you know, don't let yourself get too caught up. And like, you were influenced a little too much, particularly by a villain. He's like, what? Me? Never. Who are you talking about? He's like, you know, since the Stain incident. You know, after hearing about Stain's ideology and having to accept the reality of All Might's retirement, lots of people out there are reconsidering their attitude towards Hero. But the way you're acting now, letting notions of contempt and denial drive you, will lead you down a murky path and keep you from seeing the big picture. Kind of an interesting thing. Looks like this character is not done yet. We might have some more from him. We move around to a bunch
of different... They also note, by the way, in a throwaway line, Kamiye, the disguise girl, has gone off by herself again.
Yes.
We mistakenly thought that she had been eliminated last time, but that was confusion in interpretations of the dialogue.
Yes. Yeah. So we bounce around to a bunch of different places, and essentially what we get is Yayurozu talking about showing everybody, hey, there's a person who's injured over here. And Uraraka rushes up. She's like, I'll get it out of the way. And the injured person's already thinking, like, that decision's going to cost her points. But Yayurozu just basically creates, like, a barrier out of her arm, like, her shoulder, that just stops her rock at her tracks, just slams into her. And she explains, like, hey, look at the surroundings. If you try to move these rocks, you'll cause a break, and you might actually have everything collapse. So just wait, sit still here. I'm going to make some extra pillars for support. It's just going to take some time. And, you know, Sugar Man and Sarah will help her out. And basically then Uraraka could get in. And the person watching's like, you know, it's not bad at all. Not perfect, but, you know, in large-scale disasters, there are never quite enough rescue workers. So that means everyone who's around has to make sure every action counts as efficiently as possible. And trying to handle a job alone will only kind of waste time. So the most important thing is knowing the limits of one's quirk so that they can have their roles assigned appropriately for everyone. And this test is about showing everyone the individual merit. It's, you know, not, you may not be in the most glamorous position, but about everybody finding the role they have to play and seeing, you know, seeing what comes of it. But there's a little extra twist on it. You know, we cut over to Mineta and, Ida and Shiro, I believe is that guy?
The forum?
Soji, sorry. They're knowing, like, yeah, you know, we're not doing anything. And she was like, yeah, a good number of us, in fact, unlike in the first test, it might actually be better for us to just split up. Because that way we can kind of divide our efforts and find places where we might be more useful. And that's what they do. And we actually just get a shot of Ayama, who's just doing the laser beam thing from the ground again.
It worked last time!
And he's just like, there's some other students like, thanks for the light, now we can move forward! And that's, I guess, his contribution. We cut away then to Bakugo, and he sees two injured people who are like, we hurt ourselves, save us! Bakugo's like, save your own damn lives! And Kaminari and, Kirishima are both like, hey, you know, like, that's, I know it's your style, but man, come on, they're hurt. And the two injured people are like, I can't believe it. In this scenario, he shouldn't be focused on low priority targets like us. This kid was able to perceive that in an instant. He has to go help the greater people, telling us to save ourselves. And the other two are just like, well, at least they misunderstood the situation to his benefit. And Baku's just like, fuck this. Like, stop.
Fucking love Bakugo.
But they do say that they're deducting points for his tone. Cut away over to Deku, who's bringing the boy in that he saved last week, letting him get first aid, and we see the instructor of the whole exam is talking. He's like, yes, you know, sorting the people, this section of the nurse who says this, sorting the injured before giving first aid, that's the job we do, and the brief time it takes for ambulance to show up. And we cut over to the instructor, who is asked, how are they doing? He says, well, with the way it looks like it started, most won't make the cut. The HUC aren't handing out as many deductions as we expected, but not bad on the whole. But when it comes to protecting people in cities, a hero's job is complex and multifaceted. There's the actual rescuing, plus, and boom! This giant full-page explosion, everyone's reacting to it, like, oh, another terrorist attack? Which is actually kind of interesting, because for the students of UA, like, this is kind of almost like they should expect another villain attack. Almost every event they've had has been attacked. And everyone turns to see Gang Orca standing on over like an army of men in the most badass pose possible with a tie that resembles a tongue. And his creepy eye just saying, dealing with enemies, can you really handle both situations? And they note that he is the number 10 villain right now, but he's number 10 hero. Yeah, number 10 hero, but the number 3 hero who looks like villains. And now that Gang Orc is here, he's going to throw a wrench into their exam and you know, show them that this is what it's like to really be in a relief situation when a villain attack is happening. So this is, you know, Aizawa says this is a scenario that would even give pros a trouble. And all this for a provisional license? So Gang Orca just says, "What's your move, heroes?" as we see Todoroki, Gale Force, and Deku all turning to address him. That's a chapter.
Interesting chapter. And I do look forward to this. I'm so glad that we get more of Gang Orca!
It's so... His design is so awesome! Oh, man. That is a great, great visual. So, alright. Let's move over to Bone Piece, chapter 842, The Power of a Full Stomach. This is, of course, not a very good chapter. That's why it's not in the poll. Also because of Amalgam of Distortion. But last time, Cracker was summoning his big minions over and over again, and Luffy was just eating them over and over and over. And this one actually starts with Biscuit being really angry that, or sorry, Cracker being rather angry that he says King Baum has betrayed him. But in fact, King Baum is actually just beholden to Nami because she has Big Mom's Vivi card. I didn't quite understand why her Vivi card gives him power over them. I guess it's because part of her soul's in there, and because Big Mom has the soul fruit, that's plays into it as well. I'm not exactly sure.
I don't think that they've actually properly explained it still.
Yeah. But regardless, Nami has control over them, so she's using them to help and keep her out of the line of fire as she uses her rain to soak the Cracker minions and basically make their Biscuit minions. It fucking annoys me that they're cookies! The cookie minions! The cookie minions, and he's called Cracker! Alright? He soaks the cookie minions and makes them digestible for Luffy. And that's what's happening right now. And Luffy's basically just kind of being presented like over and over again, like, "Ugh, I'm starting to get kind of full here." And, like, Biscuit's even knowing, like, "Yeah, you're gonna go down." Or Cracker. His name's Cracker.
Yes.
Okay. It's gonna keep fucking with me until the day I die, Nick. Cracker is saying to him, like, "You can't keep eating them. Like, eventually you're just gonna burst." But Luffy's like, "Oh, I guess I could eat a little bit more." He's fine. I'm coming, Sanji.
I love the bit where this Cracker is saying, "Oh, he's almost full. He's almost says, like, let's finish this." And Nami says, "Look, you might be an imp or something or other, but Luffy's gonna be king of the pirates, and that means his hunger knows no bounds." Luffy's like, "I don't know."
So he says, "I'm coming, Sanji. I don't even care anymore," and starts eating another soldier. We cut away over to, Sweet City, where a woman is doing her makeup in the mirror when, fucking Chopper...
A face appears!
Yeah. Or was it in the lipstick? Ooh, that's another chapter. That'll be one later.
Or was there nothing there at all?
Or does she turn away from the mirror and it's a blank face with just lipstick on it? She just thinks she's a person. We see that it's, why can't I remember the rabbit's name? Carrot.
Carrot.
Easy name. There we go. Carrot and Chopper are running through, and we see that they're stuck in the mirror world still, running away from Brûlé, who's chasing after them with a scythe. Jesus. They just note they're going to keep running.
It's a bizarrely comedic panel, though, because Chopper's doing the flurry leg movement.
Yeah, like, essentially, it's what Brûlé is doing, too. You just see, like, the Hanna-Barbera legs. But you just see she's also wielding a scythe. Cut away to the castle, then, where Sanji is being held, and his sister puts on a... what looks like almost like a gel mask over top of him, and it packs his face to the point where he's no longer bruised. And he's like, "Oh, wow, the swelling's gone down." She's like, "Yeah, but that's all it does is stop the swelling. It's, you know, preventing the body's proper response, so it actually prevents healing. But this is better than having your fiancé see you with a hideous, beaten face. The Charlotte family never marries into another family to take their name. You'll be the son-in-law there, but if they like you, you can live a very happy life. And Sanji starts to, like, respond back to her, like, how dare you? But she's just like, look, you came back out of personal responsibility, so don't expect anything from me. You're not getting a second chance from me. But where did you get this sense of chivalry from? And this is sort of a weird moment. Because I guess it's Sanji who's shouting, women, women, with some other chefs. And Zeph's like,
yeah.
Shut up! We don't need a woman cook! I'm the type that likes to kick an idiot to ensure a lesson sinks in. I can't do that to a woman.
I'm an abusive boss, but I will never strike a lady. So no women folk gotta be working in here!
Look, I'm not a bad guy. I'm just saying, I couldn't have a woman working for me because I need to be able to hit her. If I can't hit her, she can't work for me. It's just who I am. It's like, this is
now,
not...
Now, if you want to judge them based on their appearance and nothing else, that is straight up fine with me.
I'm like, this is not as endearing of a message as I think Oda believes it is. I get what he's saying.
Well,
he's saying, like, it's about that men should never hit women. And that this is what's being taught into Sanji. He's like, look, I'm an old man. I have my ways, but a proper man never strikes a woman. And if you ever do it, I'm going to cut off your balls and then slit my own throat. Because as a parent, that's how you own up to your mistakes. And it's like, huh. It's just a curious sort of thing. You're always going to have that. I mean, a lot of people I know have issues with Sanji because they simply don't like the idea that has that chivalry of, like, I'm not going to strike a woman or anything like that. But it's just this phrasing here from Zeph that I guess kind of hits me in an odd way of, like, I'm never going to hire a female chef because how could I hit them? How could I beat them when I'm angry? You're like, eh.
It's really weird. And you have to be willing to look at it, I think, a certain way in order to have it come off as endearing. But it's that thing where it's like, look, you know, he has his own type of respect for women, which does not match up with modern sensibilities. He's not a feminist, he's chivalrous. And a lot of people do believe that a sense of chivalry can actually be, you know, damaging in terms of bring, you know, equality amongst the sexes, because it's showing favorability for one gender because they're the more fragile one, need to be coddled more. But in terms of he's from an older generation and he is at least going to treat that other gender favorably, then I get that. And also, you know, it is weird to kind of, I don't know, it's kind of all over the place because you've got the fact that he's beating his adoptive son. This is like, this is why I can't have any women ogling, because then how could I possibly beat up their noggin like I've done yours? As we see Sanji's got five cascading lumps growing out of his head.
Yeah, it's...
You have to be willing to look at it a certain way and find this to be endearing as opposed to, God, that dinosaur.
Yeah, I mean, Sanji even notes it afterwards. He's like, it's just a style from the age of dinosaurs. As they head off to the chateau, presumably for the wedding. We cut back to the seducing woods where Luffy has devoured another cookie minion. And he's like, oh, I told you I can't eat anymore. So Cracker's like, ha ha, it's your limit. But I don't want to ever spit up a bite of food I've taken. So Cracker charges him. He's like, then let me pierce your belly and provide some relief. As Luffy's like, no! Muscle balloon! Gear 4 Tank Man! As he's just this enormous fat Gear 4 Luffy with like the big fat cheeks, like he's storing food in them. And, Cracker's just
I love that it took three transformations in this form for Oda to put in the joke version of it.
It almost looks cooler than the other forms. I'm not gonna lie. I kind of like it better
because he looks like a sumo warrior almost.
Yeah. Cracker's like, oh, you know, can you even fight like that? And he stabs in with Pretzel, and it goes into his body, then kind of reflects out. Actually, no, he still sucks
it. Sends out ripples.
Yeah, he's like, keeps getting sucked further and further in. And Luffy says, don't soften those cookie men. Let them stay hard. Then he basically fires Cracker out and launches him through a row of his own cookie minions. And he says, fly to the end of the new world, Cannonball! And that's the chapter.
This is something that only One Piece can do.
Mm-hmm.
To shift from this ridiculous comedy fight to this insane, awesome finishing move in a split second. Because it's so cool. He reiterates his love for food, which is silly as fuck, but also, when you think about it, he's fighting for his friend Sanji, who would be really upset if he ever wasted any food. And he's using this ridiculous fad form to fucking murder Cracker by launching him through his own previously thought to be unbreakable biscuit minions. I love it. It's so great. And we don't get One Piece next week. I'm sad.
Yes. All right, let's move on to the promised Neverland, where demons roam. Chapter 10, Control. Oh, wait.
You don't really need to make a scary title for that one.
Promised Neverland, no! Chapter 10, Control. There we go. Nailed it. Slid that one in. So, Emma and them are kind of talking about their tag team, their tag match that they were having, and how now that they've had their match with Krone, they're able to start actually implementing strategy into it and start kind of changing their game to prepare themselves for the actual escape. And Norman notes, like, all right, so let's win over Dawn and Gilda soon, because they're the other two oldest kids. We'll explain the situation to them and have a lead of the two teams. And then in that moment, Ray and Norman are talking separately, and they're like, so what do we do about that problem? As he points over to Sister Krone with a fork. They explain, you know, he's like, look, only the two of us can do it. Emma just can't handle it emotionally, so we're going to have to be the ones to take care of them. But Norman's like, you know, I think what we'll do is suppress them. It's harder than killing them. It's not impossible to actually kill them. We can't kill them for another reason, essentially, like other reasons. You know, the demons have tracking devices in us, so they might have one on the caretakers, and if one of them goes out because we killed them, then they'll suddenly, you know, something will happen. Like, it might trigger them. The demons might know something's up. So it'll be easier just to restrain them and prevent them from acting. You know, Norman's going through his thought process on how it was like having mom show that, you know, tracking device, and what it seems like, you know, how his thought process is going through after that. Because he actually seems to be very bothered by the fact that he lost to mom earlier. But they just have a conversation about how mom knows who they all are, knows who all three kids essentially were that saw the scenario happen, or at least that two of them did, and that Ray's been brought in with the fold. She has an idea, it's them. But she hasn't pursued it yet. She hasn't gone after them. And they're trying to figure out why. And that's when they're starting to realize, like, maybe she already does have all that information, and it's being kind of fed to her because there's probably a traitor amongst the kids. They don't know who, and they think that it's not actually an intentional traitor. It's likely just a kid who's been feeding mom information because they love and trust her, and they don't realize what they're doing is actually betraying the three. There's a cutaway then to mom and Krone having like a conversation together, and mom essentially just like passive aggressively sort of like just puts her in her place again, where she's just like, think rationally about this. You know, there's nothing you should do other than being my pawn. You don't have to know the targets. Just do your work as a dutiful assistant, and then you can laugh about how you have something over me. and then I'll make you a mom for sure. I guarantee it. So, what did you learn playing tag with them? And she, you know, Sister Crow is just like, they're special. So mom's like, good, you understand now. And that was it. She basically is just kind of, like, pointing, like, you're smart. Don't make any more stakes in the future.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of picked it up. Well, Crone also, when she went out to play tag with the kids, she thought that she was doing it outside of mom's knowledge. And so she's now thinking, like, did she deliberately give me an opening just so that I would do that, just so I would come to this revelation? Has she actually been manipulating me this entire time? Mm-hmm. Which, of course, we saw earlier that mom, of course, is an expert at strategizing and manipulating these kids, but they're also the ones that she has raised this entire time. Of course she has this advantage over them. Everything they know, they learn from her, as opposed to someone from seemingly her own generation, or roughly equivalent to it. Now she's can do very easily the same thing to Crown.
So we cut back then to Emma and the kids, and Emma's still just like, I can't believe one of the kids betrayed us. She goes through the way I said before, that one of the kids is probably just feeding the news unintentionally. And she starts thinking about how it's impossible to get everyone back. And she thinks back to Connie, then sees all the kids as they happily march into the mouth of a demon. And that's when she's like, no, I can't leave anyone behind. So Ray says, all right, well, let's find a source of information. Let's win over Dawn and Gilda. They're like, well, what if they are? And they're like, that's fine, actually. That might actually be beneficial to us. So don't worry about it. And Norman actually says, I've already made arrangements for manipulating and confusing the enemy. And that's where we get that big flashback about how he was after he essentially felt like he lost to Mom. And you see a very dark expression on his face as he's like sitting in bed being like, think for the beginning, what's your strategy? I'm gonna help protect him. I'm gonna help everyone escape. I will not lose to Mom anymore. But he always has this smile on when he's around her. And, it's just a very creepy expression.
So the bit where, you know, he's talking about, I'm going to protect Emma, I'm going to help everyone escape, and he, it seems to perhaps hint towards the fact that he considers Emma to be special in terms of how he cares about them, compared to the other kids. So might possibly be lending credence to that thing that, maybe he's, it, like sir.
Yeah, I think he has.
But I like this little extra bit that we give where he's placing this tremendous pressure on himself. We get that bit from him, we get that bit from Norman. And meanwhile, Ray is still just kind of the guy who's just going around like, all right, so we have to, are we going to kill her? Or, you know, can we leave some of these kids behind? Because it's going to get really hard.
Fuck these babies. Fuck all these babies. And the chapter essentially ends with Norman asking Ray, like, how long will it take to break the tracking device? He's like, I think I could probably do it about 10 days from now. And that's when Norman's like, okay, so let's do our escape 10 days from now. That's the end of the chapter.
A couple of notes. Ray specifically says that they've got at minimum a month and a half until the next shipment. So that sets the hard time limits as they know it. It's possible that they could fail in this first breakout attempt and have more time to later. Another thing I have to note is that Promised Neverland is apparently polling well in Japan.
That's good.
It was it got a color page in the, to start off this week, and stuff that I'm looking at is, you know, because it only would have started showing its ranking recently, but it seems to be, you know, in the upper third. So it seems to be doing well, which I'm happy about.
Very much
so. Also, that color page, love that color page. That's a really cool looking title page that we get with the three kids, you know, leading groups of children on this spiraling flight of stairs trying to avoid danger. It's a cool visual. And, of course, we're getting basically confirmation that the two other kids are going to be brought into the fold.
Yes. So let's move on to Red, Spite of the Damned, cursing you from their graves. Chapter 7, Alfred. Boo. So, we know that there are 7 kids that Tatsu wants to save. Tatsu Frumpf. And we already have one of them with Mono. So we're now moving on to the next one, Alfred. As is sort of explained, Alfred was the big brother at the orphanage. He was the older one who kind of looked after Tatsu. And he's now the one who's escaped. He's the one who's out in the wind. Basically, the other people are trying to explain, like, yeah, well, the underground city offers the most promise, but there's a good chance we might die before we get there. Tatsu's like, hey, it wouldn't be underground. I know that for sure since I was down there for the past 6 years. So Fall says, well, the only alternative is the Nerubian Kingdom. It's one of the few nations currently not governed by Edenia, the big empire. So that's where they decide to head. That's, you know, where they'll go next. And the other, I can't remember if this guy actually has a name. The bald guy who he keeps punching. I don't remember.
I'm sure he does, but I can't remember it.
Yeah, so what was this Alfred guy like? And that's what Tatsu says. Like, he was like a big brother. And that's really what he was. He was the guy who looked out for Tatsu the most. He was kind of the one trying to use logic with all their, like, childlike fascinations going wild. Like, how do we find it? Like, let's all use our telescopes on a clear day. He's like, what? No, hold on. Wait, it's covered in cloud and no one's ever seen it. Like, that's just not going to work. But all their kind of like wild idealism, he's the one kind of trying to put logic into it. And mm-hmm. I like that the monk there was like, I shouldn't have told them about this country. But
I like the way that, Alfred sums it all up, which is all of Tatsu's plans are crazy. So I, being 1 year older, must protect everyone.
Yes. And that's how he felt as a
child. It's all killed unless I fulfill my duty as the oldest kid and protect everyone.
It's a really actually kind of an inspiring message because, you know, it's right now it's spoken as a kid who's, you know, just looking out for his other younger siblings from their, you know, like imaginary plaything. But you get the sense that's probably what he still thinks now. So we cut over to this army that's trying to kill this cloaked figure. And they can't. He pulls off his cloak, and there are just guns now floating in the air around him, and he has this weird magnetic pool where he's actually, like, setting all the guns up in an arc around him and using them to, like, fire and take out soldiers, and, you know, he's using this enormous, like, almost like a wicket bat. Or not wicket bat, like a cricket bat, sorry. Like a giant one, I guess, made out of some kind of ore, because he's holding up, like, via magnetism, uses it to block artillery shells, and then has, like, an electro shotgun that he shoots off at people. I think it basically even destroys the gun every time he fires it, it looks like. And he's using that to take out tanks. Then he swings his giant weapon and just, like, cleaves through an entire army, like, knocking all the soldiers aside and destroying their tanks. And that's where you get, like, a half-page spread of him saying, I won't let you steal anymore, and that's our first introduction to Alfred McGinnis.
He's a fucking badass.
that is a pretty badass chapter to be introducing him in.
I love the thing that we're starting to get a little bit of distinction in terms of how the kids are going to be using their abilities. So they all seem to be, like, they're going to be electricity related, but, you know, Alfred used that in terms of electromagnetism. And he used that in a bunch of cool ways in just this one chapter, and he just looks cool. Yes. With his long codes and his very simple facial and hair design. But yeah, he just wrecks this army, and cool chapter.
It helps too that he had a cool little moment in the flashback too, mm-hmm. to give you a sense of what character he probably is.
Absolutely.
So, let's move on to Torment Co. Chapter 390, Akashia's Goals. What even happens in this chapter? So,
I don't know.
Midora is still fighting Akashia, and his hand has been bitten off already. And he's trying to use his tongue to, like, you know, his tongue that just, like, kind of rips people apart and devours them. Mm-hmm. Neo starts trying to eat it, and they have, like, a big, like, fist punch that creates a giant explosion. So Midoriya, like, brings his tongue up into the air and slams it onto the planet over and over again, which I feel like is when Setsuna just mentioned a little bit ago. Like, I definitely can't take another planet-destroying event! Please don't! But that's when Neo, like, snaps in the air and presumably eats Midoriya's tongue, or Midoriya's tongue, which is kind of disturbing in a lot of ways, and then impales him. And is, like, it looks like he's trying to eat his shoulder with his, like, tendril that he sends out. And he's like, in this world, Midoriya, there are only two kinds of creatures, those who eat and those who are eaten. In this giant food chain pyramid of this vast cosmos, Neo reigns on the very top. Midoriya, you made it pretty far up the chain, but in the end, you're one of the ones who gets eaten. And that's when Toriko comes in and effortlessly, well, not effortlessly, but, like, very cleanly just chops off the tendril that Acacia released and basically saves Midoriya, like, pulls it off of him and eats it. And he's like, if there are only two kinds of creatures, then you're one of the ones who gets eaten, too.
Ha! Showed you.
Got him. Nailed him. That's, Acacia notes, like, oh, he packed his fist with all of his body weight and burning rage, and Toriko punches him and sends him flying. And is like, Midoriya, are you alright? He's like, I'm fine. When it comes to physical attacks, that is, we have to be on guard from Neo's consuming attacks. If he takes a bite out of you, you can never regenerate that part again. What we need is an attack with destructive speed and destructive force that's too much for him to make a meal out of. And Toriko's like, no, that's the other way around. I have to let him take a bite out of me. You're the one who gave me that hit. When I bit into Neo just now, I felt a strong stress coming from Neo's meat. It seems like only your attack caused some heavy damage to Neo. We can't even give him a scrap of the kinds of emotional flavors Neo prefers, like fear and despair. Neo can't stand attacks packed with rage. And that seems to be what Acacia himself is hoping for. So, Midoriya's like, fear, huh? The only time I've ever felt a true shudder of fear was from that mysterious appetite that lurks within you, Toriko. And Toriko says, I'll take it from here. I know what he's really after. And apparently Earth's destruction has begun, because the Earth's, like, exploding. Like, there's
fuck all this.
Yeah, just fucking going. And Acacia's like, I liked that punch just now. It had some strong rage in it. And they're going to see which one of them has their gourmet dream come true. As Acacia, this is kind of a lame part, but has, like, the Neo face appear on his chest and his arms and his knees. And
he's, I got mouths everywhere!
Yeah. Don't you mean, which one of us is closer to divinity? And Toriko's like, no, which one of us is hungrier? Then we cut to the spirit world, where Ichiryu, we see him for the first time in a very long time, since he died, actually. And he's like, this place is huge. In fact, it's too big. It's like a giant labyrinth. It's so huge, it reminds me of the endless cosmos. It's a place that's packed with powerful energy. This is a living, savoring energy. This is, and then he sees, essentially, like, a giant mess, like a swarm of Neos, just, or Nitros, rather, just swirling around each other, I guess, like, kind of in just a pile. And that's where the chapter ends. I don't know what happens at the end there. I have no clue.
Don't really know either.
That's the chapter.
I don't really have much to say about this, honestly. It didn't leave very little impact on me. I remembered very little of it.
And now it's time for our final series of the recap, World Trigger, by Daisuke Ashihara. Chapter 160, Hyusei, Part 4, Boo. So last...
shouldn't have let you do this.
So last time, Hyusei was basically kicking the ass of everybody in B rank. and climbing his way up the ranks very quickly. He was already B-ranked by the end of the last chapter when Akoma challenged him to a battle, a solo rank war, first to five wins. What essentially happens is Akoma takes the first win. Akoma takes the first win. Then Husei takes the next two. And then Husei ties it up 4-4. And, Akoma's like, you've got some strange sword skills and you're much tougher than I thought. And Husei just thinks poorly on himself. He's like, it's no doubt I'm out of practice. Get a grip. Who do I think taught me how to use a sword? And you see a shot of him learning the sword from, Visa. And Husei looks to be trying to, make a critical attack. And that's when Akoma's like, gotcha! And uses Whirlwind. And that's when he's like, crap. And he gets disqualified for using the Whirlwind. So,
God damn it, Akoma, we told you not to use it. No, it's the habit, though. We told you not to use the Whirlwind. You're not allowed to.
So, Husei wins, but the last match is kind of not counting because Husei was just, or Akoma was just an idiot who got himself disqualified.
It's like a guy who forgets that he can't use a chair shot in this match. Whoops!
Yeah, oh, I thought I was allowed to punch people in the balls this match. Like, no! Why would that be allowed?
Damn it, that completely takes away one of my signature techniques, the testicular crush.
I always felt like, how does Goldust do the Shattered Dreams in matches if that's very distinctly, just a shot to the man's genitals?
Apparently, it was very inconsistently enforced. Like, sometimes they would be like, oh, it's okay, it's his finishing move, but other times they would be like, no, DQ. But it's like how, supposedly at some point, closed fist punches were illegal, and the Big Show made his finishing move a closed fist punch. So, so if you do it as your finisher, it's okay.
Yeah.
And then eventually they're just like, fuck it, just punch each other, go ahead.
Whatever.
You're stomping on the mat anyway while swinging your fist at nothing.
You're only doing this because you fucking got crushed by Floyd Mayweather at a WrestleMania, so who cares? Why didn't you get a sumo finisher after getting your shit kicked in by Akimoto? Tachikawa shows up and he's like, oh, what do we have here? You guys look like you're having fun.
He's going to have a slam dunk finisher when he retires.
He doesn't even actually say, let's have a match. They just immediately go into one, in which Tachikawa wins decisively 5-1, though Husei apparently won the first match.
They say it was the first one, but if you look at the scoreboard, it's actually the fourth one he won.
Huh, yeah, that is weird. I didn't expect to lose. Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe he just caught him off guard and attacked him really quickly in that one, that's what they mean.
Very, very possible. Husei seems like he's, kind of bummed, but, the one instructor's like, yeah, that guy's the number one attacker. And this is where Husei's able to kind of place himself. He's like, all right, so I lost to this guy, and I was kind of on the same level as the number six guy from before. So that means my skills are somewhere around here from now. And he kind of places himself in that medium, around the number six attacker in border range.
Not bad for his first day.
Yeah. But he's like, no, that's not accurate because Meiden uses triggers that combine multiple functions together. So if they were all fully geared, they'd all be much stronger. That's when he thinks back to, not Husei. Who's the leader of the Meiden group? The guy with the egg.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember that guy. I feel like that was the guy who said that the progress in Meiden has been most impressive. So that's essentially
Hirene.
There we go. I knew it was another H. He says, I will learn from them. I'll continue taking advantage of their VR system. And it's pretty impressive, though, how far they've gotten. Two of the members try to say, hey, you want to join the team? You said pretty good.
When losers.
Yeah, Husei is like, I already made a promise to someone else. Cut over to Tamakoba 2, where Konami's
Before we move on to that, I like the observations that he's making about the training area. Where it's they're able to practice this freely and go all out because of this technology. Their trion technology overall is a long ways to go, but they're using it in interesting, unique ways. And I also like that he's making this observation. Tachikawa and Ikoma are hanging out. Like, hey, you want to go spar over here and stuff? You know, just all getting along in general.
Yeah, and it's just a way for them to all better themselves. So Konami's like, oh, you made B-rank? Wow, that's really impressive. And I think even Asamu's like, but your introduction ceremony was only today. Exactly. and I like that Yotaro's like, that's my boy, Husei, and gives him a fist bump. Which Husei actually does in response. Like, boom.
It's adorable, isn't it? Like, they're buddies. He likes his little Yotaro friend.
Husei can't figure out chopsticks, but he's nailed daps already. it's like, hey, you know, only going up with a sword, I was also about as good as the number 6 attacker. So I was going to use my sword as my primary trigger, but I think I might need to think about it a little bit more. So clearly he's putting some thought into this instead of just going with what his first thought was. It seems like having gone through some of the toughest attackers out there has made him rethink his strategy a bit and be good for him. Mm-hmm. So, Shiori, that's her name, right? Shiori?
Yes.
Shiori's like, oh, you already got promoted to B rank. That's amazing. I got a gift prepared for you, and she gives him his Tamakoma 2 outfit, and she's like, oh, it looks good. And then she just demands the rest of them change into their outfit so she can get, like,
we're taking family pictures. Everyone line up. Short kids in the back. Okay, Samu, put your hands on Chika's shoulders. Hughes, do the same to Yuma. And none of you are smiling. Well, Yuma, you're kind of smiling, but Yuma, don't do a duck face. Yuma. This is a serious picture. We'll do a silly one later. Stop fighting. Stop horsing around. Oh my god.
Osamu, can you take down Chica's cowlick? It is getting really annoying. Also, comb your hair. All of you, comb your hair.
All of you. Wait, hang on. You've got a little spot. Hang on.
It is kind of nice, though, to see them all in their team outfit, and Husei even has, like, little, I don't know what you'd call them, but almost like dangles coming from, like, the left side of, or right side of his outfit. Almost like they'd be, like, on a military commander's outfit. Like, they seem rather kind of prestigious. So Osamu's like, nice to have you on board. And Husei immediately is like, don't take this the wrong way. We're not friends. We're in a cooperative relationship and share a mutual interest. Let me clarify. I will not follow your orders 100% of the time. It's only when I deem them necessary and right to do them that I shall follow them.
And so really, like, I'm not actually going to follow your orders at all.
Not whatsoever. And that's when Yuma's like, you're not going to follow orders? That's going to bring chaos in the battlefield. I cannot allow myself to be killed for following the wrong directions. I believe only in my judgment and will allow my actions as they deem it. I'll only follow you basically when I hear that you've made a good decision. And Osama's like, okay, I'll let you do that for now.
Because what the fuck else am I going to do?
Yeah, what am I going to do? He's like, I just expect that you share the strength during your expedition. He's like, that goes without saying. And Konami's like, oh, hey, yeah, make sure you guys stay together tomorrow. I want to introduce you all to Yuri. Two of the members of our scouting, who are scouting outside the prefecture, are coming back. Yuri Rindo and Michael Cronin. There are older members, and your superiors. Ba-bum.
So yeah, I'm looking forward to that little revelation, but I do dig the interaction that Hughes has got going on with the rest of Tamakoma 2. And, you know, this whole thing about him being independent from the rest of them is going to pop up in the future. Either it's going to work against them, or presumably he's going to learn to actually respect Osamu's command or something like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can't have development if there's not an issue to be overcome at some point. So I'm glad that despite the fact that he's agreed to team up with them, it's still kind of a contentious relationship.
Yes. All right.
Did like this chapter. And I like this little side arc into Hughes becoming an agent, sparring with everybody. But I also like the little look into his past where we see that he and Visa have known each other since he was a kid.
Yeah, there's definitely
Did they ever establish that Visa knew that they were planning on leaving Hughes behind?
Um, I honestly, I can't remember. I feel like they did, but maybe, I thought they
even adoring about it, so.
I thought they mentioned that there was someone they didn't tell for that specific reason. And maybe it was Visa. Oh, he did? He did now?
He did. Wow. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Well.
Be interested to see. Still apparently respects him, so who knows. All right. That's going to do it for our weekly manga recap. So let's move on to weekly MVPs and chapter of the week.
I'm going to name chapter of the week as I think everyone already called this at the beginning of the episode. But it's our new series, Amalgam of Distortion. I thought it was just an incredibly effective opening chapter. So this is like the second jumpstart in two months that I'm giving the first chapter as my chapter of the week for.
And I will share that sentiment with you. I'm giving it to Amalgam of Distortion as well. It was a really good chapter. And our audience chapter of the week is World Trigger by a single vote, actually, over My Hero Academia.
Very close.
So, of course, some people are going to call foul because One Piece was an option.
Recount.
Yeah, I heard all about your plan to vote for Fairy Tail in response, and I'll tell you, even with that, Fairy Tail was a distant like fifth. So I don't think it would have mattered that much.
Did not work. God. I'm going to go with Alfred from Red Sprite as my MVP. Badass introduction. I did consider a couple of others. I actually considered giving it to Nami for her role in the fight against Biscuit, which is a welcome little detail. Because Luffy was losing that fight badly, and then her interference allowed him to turn things around. So.
Yes. I'm going to give my character MVP to Gang Orca, because I just love that dude's design, and I'm so glad. It was like a legitimate moment of excitement when it showed up in the chapter. I was like, holy shit, Gang Orca is going to be an actual character in this! Fuck yeah! I was so stoked.
All I did was show up.
I know, but I just thought he'd never be an important character. And it's like, oh, fuck, he's the teacher at this, or the hero at this exam. So I was like, oh, that's fucking pimp. And I love that his tie is a tongue, or it looks like a tongue. It's so cool. So, there we go. You want to wrap things up, or?
Yeah, I can handle it. Thanks everyone for joining us for Weekly Manga Recap. We tend to record the show on hitbox.tv/RoloT Wednesdays at 7 PM Eastern Standard Time, but sometimes we do need to change things up in case technical difficulties like Skype's continued refusal to cooperate occur. And you can stay updated on all that stuff where we're going to be recording the show by following us on Twitter. You can follow the official @WMR podcast account as well as us individually @RoloT and @YRollerOfTime. Be sure to check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com, and of course subscribe to us on iTunes, where you can leave a comment or rating to help us beat the woodworkers, and also subscribe to us on YouTube if you want to watch the visual editions of the show.
Yes, I want to give a special thank you to W of MD, who gave us a 5-star review. He says, listen to the Air Gear review, 5 stars just for the Air Gear review. So a lot of people enjoyed that episode, and I'm glad you were able to give us a 5-star review. Thank you very much. It's greatly appreciated.
It's worth all the torture now.
Yeah. And the continued torture I have rereading it for more stupid moments to put in that top 10.
Be sure to send us criticism, ask us questions, and suggest future read by sending that stuff to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Chris, are you going to have a suggestion?
Yes, I have a suggestion.
Cool. Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. We're going to have some stuff coming out for you guys soon. As soon as Nick can breathe normally.
Yeah. Don't worry, guys. We're going to get to all that stuff soon. I do have also a special thanks to a new patron. We have Stephen McAfee is our newest patron. So thank you very much, Stephen. It is greatly appreciated. Boosh. You got daps. I'm like the Yotaro to your Husei. He's like, I don't listen to World Trigger. I didn't get that reference.
And, of course, special thanks to the guys who help us make this show possible, Infamous Planet and Steve Mann. You can follow Steve Mann's various art accounts in different places to check out his stuff, and also the tile cards that he's made for us.
Yes, his one for Fuwan Otane, it's not up here right now, but it'll be up on the YouTube and everything like that, is appropriately creepy. So look forward to seeing that. And I believe he actually sent out a link. I know a lot of people were asking for the Air Gear title card as wallpaper. He was very very smitten to hear that. I think he made another version available. So,
okay.
Yeah. I think that's it. Annalisa in the chat's asking if the next Ashihara Sensei care package prize should be a World Trigger cell phone strap or poster. The anime art on the poster. All right. Be interesting. Send your responses to her at Kaito underscore Ace. Let her know which one you think.
What Halloween series are we going to do next, Chris?
Well, this suggestion was sent to us by Ribble Roth, who's a lovely artist who has sent us a couple of different fan art pieces recently. She also recommended us to check out a series called Emerging. It is about a large-scale sanitary crisis that takes over. And what would happen in Shujinku if a man exploded in the street during broad daylight? It is a horror series about essentially like a giant infection spreading. So it's only 2 volumes long. I believe we'll have it in time for next week. And I think it'll be pretty cool. So that's going to do it. I think next week I should have more elaborate puns for every chapter title.
Damn it.
I think it's time for me to start really going all out with these Halloween episodes.
I hate you.
Maybe put some like pumpkins over here, like right there. Get like a bat wing. Maybe I just have bats hanging around my room. That'll be pretty sweet.
Why not?
Alright, sweet. Next week, bats. Wild and just attacking everything within my room.
Welcome to Wiggly Mongery Cafe.
I get rabies for your benefit, everybody. That's commitment. Give me a 5-star review for this, goddammit. If I'm getting rabies, I better sure as hell be in the top 50 hobby podcasts on iTunes.
Damn right.